It's very important to have a national plan when you're dealing with risks of this scope, breadth, and potential harm.
Hello and welcome to Energy 360, the podcast from the Energy Security and Climate Change Program at CSIS. I'm your host, Lisa Hyland. This week, we welcome back to the show climate risk and resilience expert Alice Hill. Alice recently released a new book, The Fight for Climate After COVID-19. Talking with our program director, Joseph Mikut, Alice looks at the collective responses to the COVID-19 global pandemic as a way to help us think about better planning for climate preparedness. And this is especially important as the climate community gets ready for the upcoming COP26 meetings, and climate resilience is expected to be a significant part of those discussions. Alice and Joseph look at the need for states to create national plans to build resilience and to combat climate risks. And they look at how to make sure those plans are shared with all stakeholders, from local to federal and from public to private, that those plans are funded and stay funded, and that these policies need to be reviewed and updated on a regular basis. Here's Joseph to lead the conversation.
Welcome, Alice, to the Energy 360 podcast. Very grateful that you are joining us today. Your most recent book is The Fight for Climate After COVID-19. And when I think about the true experts in building climate resilience through government policy and changes to how markets govern themselves, you're one of them. You've previously served as a senior director for resilience policy at the National Security Council. And, you know, relevant to our conversation today, you also, in an earlier position, led the DHS leadership group coming up with how plans for biosecurity, pandemic preparedness. And so these connections between COVID-19 and climate, you're sort of perfectly positioned to help us understand them. So thank you for joining us today. Given where we are today, recording in October of 2021, and the Conference of the Parties coming up at Glasgow, what role do you think resilience and adaptation will play at the COP?
Well, adaptation should take a bigger place in the negotiations at COP. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for exactly that. He said that adaptation, which is preparing for responding to the impacts of climate change, like deeper droughts, bigger storms, sea level rise, has to be given the same weight and consideration as the other side of climate change, which is, of course, the mitigation of emissions. That's reducing the amount of carbon that's forming this thick blanket around the globe, which is in turn resulting in temperatures rising, which bring about all those impacts. So the goal here is to make sure that with financing, with attention from national governments, we're getting adaptation to play and greater consideration.
For my own understanding, you know, when we talk about resilience or adaptation to the effects of climate change, are those two things the same, or are, you know, how do those concepts relate when you're in these discussions?
Well, that's a great question because they are used interchangeably. In fact, I typically use them interchangeably, but they are slightly different in concept. Adaptation is truly addressing the changes that are brought by rising temperatures. So that means that you have to build your bridge higher so that floodwaters, either from extreme precipitation falling all at once or sea level rise or both, will be accommodated by the height of that bridge. You adapt by raising the bridge. Resilience is a much broader concept. It talks about responding to, recovering from, and really bouncing back from these events. Resilience has gained in popularity because it's less politically charged. Adaptation is strongly tied to climate change. Resilience, as we see in any bookshelf in any bookstore, when we still could go there, there are just thousands of books with resilience in the title, because it could be resilience, our personal resilience, our mental health, the resilience of our children, or resilience of communities to shocks from natural disasters. Political reasons why politicians choose to use resilience to avoid discussion of climate change, particularly here in the United States. But really, for our purposes, or my purposes of talking about climate change, I use them interchangeably.
Thank you. That's actually quite helpful. Your book is about building back better in an adaptation sense after COVID-19. And I think it's very helpful to start to think about climate risk as it relates to what we've just experienced during the pandemic. I was looking this morning at Our World in Data, and the US had a fairly high number of excess deaths per capita as a result of COVID-19. And we trail only a few countries, Russia, Iran, South Africa, Mexico, Brazil, not places of high state capacity in general opinion. But many of our peers in Western Europe and East Asia did significantly better during the COVID period. What could we have done differently in the US regarding COVID-19?
Well, it is very similar to climate change in that probably the most important thing is early action. And you can contrast what we did here in the United States as this disease began to emerge, reports of the disease from Wuhan, China, and what happened in South Korea. So it turns out that COVID-19 arrived on the very same day, or was detected on the very same day here in the United States as it was in South Korea. The president at the time, President Trump, said, essentially, it's no big deal. It's only one case. He said specifically, it's just one person coming in from China. We have it under control. Korea, now they had been hit by previous threats like SARS and MERS. They mobilized like this was a national threat, which it proved to be, immediately. They pulled in resources all over the place. They were like an army. They copied Starbucks, for example, in establishing drive-through testing centers because they thought that's a quick way to make sure if anyone's ill. They established contact tracing so that they could make sure that anyone who'd been exposed would be alerted and then could take necessary steps to stop the spread of the disease. Now, when shortly after the pandemic began to emerge, and by February, Korea had more cases than any other nation except China. But if we look at just this summer, in a population of 50 million, they had just a little over 2,000 deaths. And the U.S. this summer had, at the same time, had about 658,000 deaths. And of course, that's increased since then. So early action based on the science can yield substantially better results. And that's true for climate change as well.
So in our response to COVID in the US context, we saw breakdowns both in government and among citizens. So examples that for me are the CDC failed to produce a COVID test in time for it to matter, which is that early response issue. The FDA tied up vaccine approvals and sort of old, very risk-averse models for drug approvals. And then there, you know, mask and now vaccine resistance have been common in at least large geographical swaths of the U.S. What lessons can we take from those failures as we consider building resilience to the effects of climate change? What are the relative roles of citizen response versus increased state capacity?
Well, I think that for both catastrophic risks, the model that will best accommodate the or contain the threat is, first of all, defining the role of the government in this, making sure that all stakeholders understand what the role of the federal government is. And one example of that in the COVID situation would be stockpiling of medical necessary supplies. We saw immediately we were running into shortages. That should be understood as a federal government support to state and local governments and be exercised and practiced. Similarly, with regard to climate change, of course, we're going to need emergency management to support that. But what is the federal government's role there? The federal government's role is to provide great science, downscaled science, that is science relevant to the communities so that they can understand their risks, and programs that will help build capacity to respond to those risks, be it drought, extreme heat, sea level rise, or a combination of all three of those. And so it's very important to have a national plan when you're dealing with risks of this scope, breadth, and potential harm. We had a national plan, but that was largely abandoned by the Trump administration for COVID-19. We have no national adaptation plan at this point yet for the threat of climate change.
And if you were building that national plan, do you think of this as a new job for existing institutions, or is there a degree at which institutional reform will be necessary to really respond to climate risk adequately?
Well, I think that's a chicken and egg problem, but I do think in this case, the first, very basic step is to develop a national plan. What would a national plan get you? Well, first of all, it would allow you to define the roles from, as you've said, the individual citizen to state, local, tribal, territorial governments, to the private sector, to civil society, to the federal government. So there's a much greater understanding of how these different actors will be responding to climate change. It then would allow you to establish a national metric to determine, are we resilient? Are the choices we're making making us more resilient as we move forward? It would then allow us also to prioritize what investments make sense. You know, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, which is essentially the watchdog for the federal government, has called out the federal government for its lack of a plan. And one of the risks of choosing not to have a plan is that when questions of funding projects come up, we just default to sprinkling money across different projects without stepping back and saying, you know, will that set of investments really keep us safe? Or do we need to think about different, maybe larger investments, different types of investments to actually accomplish the job of building resilience for the nation? A national adaptation plan would help us accomplish that and then improve our spending over time. It's an iterative process. It would require that United States engage in an analysis. What are we currently facing and what are our future vulnerabilities? We've had the summer that has allowed pretty much most Americans to look out their window and discover that climate impacts bring really harmful events. But we need to have better vulnerability assessments so that communities can know what's ahead and then start making the right types of changes. The ultimate goal of any plan would be to systematically integrate climate change into planning and budgetary processes. Eventually, that it would provide a really responsible way to have the engagement of all levels of society in this fight, including the private sector.
When I think about climate risk, you mentioned the GAO. A few years ago, they published, you know, the inadequacy of responding to climate risk as one of the key financial risks facing the federal government. But you've got lots of principal actors around the country that face climate risks and some duty to respond to them, right? Whether that's like firms and businesses, municipalities, the states to some extent. In your estimation, do we have any idea when you add all those things up, how much climate adaptation really will be in the coming decades? Or is that kind of assessment the what would underlie a national planning exercise?
Well, I don't think we have a clear picture of what all the levels of adaptation that will be required for climate change. Of course, there's an uncertainty here. It depends on our emissions, the global emissions, how much warming we will suffer, and then how bad these events will get. But I would say that adaptation here in the United States, as it was described in the United Kingdom by their head of their adaptation efforts, is under-resourced, underfunded, and largely ignored. Basically, we haven't engaged deeply yet on adaptation efforts. There's some notable exceptions to that. There's some plans underway, and there's some particular projects underway, but we haven't done that step back, figure out what really needs to occur. Because often those questions or that assessment will raise very difficult questions about where populations should live, how we should be using land. Do we need to abandon certain sites because they're going to get too soggy or they'll burn too much? And those discussions are really hard. In Del Mar, California, the California Coastal Commission, which is responsible for ensuring access to public beaches, the commission tried to get communities to come up with a managed retreat plan. That's a plan for if land is eroded by sea level rise, what are you going to do, city, to address that? And The citizens of Del Mar, which is one of the most affluent places in the United States and most affluent places along the California coast, those citizens said, we don't want to discuss this. It's going to harm our property values. We don't think we need to retreat. A variety of reasons were raised, just indicating how hard it is to talk about people leaving the homes that they love, that they're their primary investment, that they have a deep emotional attachment. That's just not easy to do. So it will be a process, but we need to get started on understanding where we need to make the investments and what those investments would look like for adaptation.
Oh, that's really interesting. Thank you. The imagery of climate impacts, it really sort of matters, I think. You know, a decade ago, imagery of climate resilience or climate impact might have been hurricanes, superstorms. But in the last 2 years, we've seen these incredible wildfires in the West. We've seen flooding events. What do you think will be the key images of climate impact in the coming few years? And do you think that the sort of imperative to build resilience will arise as climate impacts become either more extreme or more obvious?
Well, climate change poses a challenge in terms of galvanizing the necessary focus, finance, and energy to address it, because each of these impacts come in a very localized way. And so it depends on the geography, that particular area, what they will suffer. And that can make it hard for communities to pick out what they want to do unless they have that information. And right now, although the Biden administration just recently announced new efforts to make more data and information available, but it's hard for a part-time mayor, and I met such a part-time mayor. She was leading the town of Perdido Beach in Alabama, a very aptly named place. It's along the Gulf, beautiful, but it suffers from sea level rise, potential oil spills, and the threats of bigger storms. And Mayor Parker told me, look, I'm a part-time mayor. I don't have a planning staff, don't really have any resources. I understand that I'm facing climate risk, but what should I do about it? And unfortunately, unless she has the funds to hire an outside consultant or knows whom to contact in the vast sprawling set of agencies we have in the federal government, it's hard to come by that answer, much less find the financing and the political will to make the investments. So that will be a challenge going forward. And we do see, however, and I'll just mention this, exciting efforts to help visualize the risks that are occurring. And there's a small but mighty NGO, Climate Central, that's focused on this. Right in advance of COP26, the Conference of Parties, which will occur in Glasgow in early November, they have released 1,000 images that have been peer-reviewed to show the flooding risk in different iconic locations around the world. So if you're a Nats fan, you can see what's going to happen to the stadium. If you are thinking about Glasgow, they covered the convention center where the Conference of Parties will occur. And both places, they essentially end up as lakes if we have 3 degrees Celsius warming, which is the path that we're currently on if we don't really seriously reduce our carbon emissions.
So Climate Central can show us lots of interesting imagery about a climate change future in individual locations. One of the themes in your book, though, is that climate change is sort of a compounding risk. And so a lot of what individuals might experience will be different in a climate-changing world than the Nats Park turning into a pond. We have recent experience with this from COVID-19, right? Supply chain interruptions and instability continue to be a problem even today, a year and a half into the extreme part of this pandemic. How do you think about that in the climate change scenario? Does our failure to keep supply chains static and flowing in COVID-19 portend bad things for climate change?
Absolutely. We have seen catastrophic risk can disrupt supply chains in very unanticipated ways. For example, when Mexico shut down some manufacturing facilities because there was a spread of COVID, that reverberated across the world. And we see similar things when we're talking about climate impacts. One example is Hurricane Maria, a huge storm that pummeled the island of Puerto Rico. Many medical institutions discovered after that event that one of their major sources for pharmaceuticals was from Puerto Rico. But Puerto Rico suffered the second largest blackout in the history of the world. The island was dark essentially for a year. And even as these pharmaceutical manufacturers tried to get power and they were given priority, for example, by the federal government in recognition of their important mission, they discovered that they couldn't get people to work because the roads were blocked. The people couldn't make their way into the facilities. So one of the big lessons from COVID as well as climate change, as told to me by a supply chain expert, is nobody knows where their goods are, full stop. And that's a quote. So much greater work needs to go into understanding how our supply chains work and how they're vulnerable. These very thin chains that wrap around the world are vulnerable to increasingly extreme events from climate change.
Yeah, I think that it's such a great example of the nature of risk that we're trying to talk about, right? So, you know, in a first order way, you can think about COVID. It's obviously a terrible disease. It's the sort of impact you might get if you get a case. Many people don't experience anything. Some people get moderately sick. A smaller proportion get very sick, and some people die. And there's sort of an analogy to climate where many people probably won't feel the effects directly. So it'll be catastrophic for some, right? Coastal communities or people who suffer weather calamities in a changing climate. But those secondary effects seem really important to me. So how do we build a resilient society for those secondary effects where it's not necessarily as predictable as, well, the sea level is going to be 3 feet higher in a particular point by a particular date?
That's a really important point. One of the first places to start is to build more resilient systems so that we anticipate, for example, that there will be a break in the supply chain. And solutions for that are to have greater clarity as to what the sources are, have multiple sources available. And then for critical supplies that could mean life or death for some nations, like food, that you stockpile so that you can get through these critical moments and not have populations deeply harmed by what has occurred. So that's rethinking our supply chains. Another thing that we need to rethink is, how does emergency preparedness change as a result of climate change? You know, a friend of mine who works at FEMA told me that FEMA experts just never imagined that there would be a response required in every single state as well as six territories simultaneously, and that's COVID-19. So as we see big storms, wildfires, drought, heat extremes that are killer events occur during a pandemic, it's made clear that we need to have redundancy in our emergency response capabilities as well. Two obvious places to start are to build surge capabilities, and that means being able to call on, in the case of FEMA, employees from across the federal government to come and assist, or in a city, as Paris has done, train citizens who are able to respond to a catastrophe and lend support to emergency managers and responders. Another thing to do is to figure out better ways to lend a helping hand and receive a helping hand. That is, bolster our mutual aid agreements. We have some good examples of this with wildfire. There's a history of wildfire fighters and supplies, like these big planes that can dump a lot of water on wildfires, being traded back and forth between the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere because the wildfire seasons were generally different. Now we're getting to a situation with climate change where the wildfire season can stretch all year long, but there's still going to be more room in either hemisphere to add, during the most extreme moments, additional resources. And that takes planning, thought, working, building the relationships, establishing the requirements, coming to agreements on things like who's going to pay, what's the liability, do our workers have immunity, all those technical issues that can slow down the arrival of help. And that's just a matter of pre-planning.
So you mentioned in the book the shift in some places to cash assistance as a trend during COVID, right? Examples range from Afghanistan to Canada to the United States. This was found to be an effective, fast, easy way to help people during a crisis, especially vulnerable communities. Change the way you think about building resilience to climate change and the modalities that we use to do so?
Yes. I think it's been a dramatic example that we can get cash into people's hands quickly to help change the outcomes. There are two places where cash can be particularly helpful, and they're related, but it's to help people evacuate. You know, many Americans don't have $400 available to them to allow them to evacuate. So you saw during Hurricane Katrina, for example, that people were left behind. They just didn't have the resources to get out of New Orleans in advance of the storm. We need to make sure that we are thinking through how we can help people move out of harm's way quickly, and that will probably take some cash. And another way is an expanding area that will be very important. This is called forecast-based financing. It takes the concept that for every dollar you provide someone in advance or provide an effort in advance of a disaster, you can get savings of $6, $7, $13, depends on the calculation, in avoided damages. So investing ahead of time in reducing risk has a huge payoff in terms of the amount of damage suffered. And so what we're seeing is countries are beginning to look at the forecast, and then if the forecast says there's going to be a big storm, figuring out ways to get cash to people in advance so they can secure the supplies they need. They can get plywood to secure their homes. They can evacuate themselves and their livestock. On the back end, this means that after the disaster is struck, more livelihoods are preserved. Children remain in school. This is particularly important in the developing world where children are pulled out of school, and often it's the girls. And food security remains because they've been able to purchase food in advance, and we don't have hungry children, hungry families in the wake. So this model of not waiting for disaster to happen before you provide aid, but instead providing aid before the disaster strikes, is a growing trend across the world. It's far more reliable than our current system, which typically depends on donor nations coming together to figure out how they're going to help out a suffering country. It can be a very slow, erratic process that gets help to people too late before they've suffered these terrible harms of losing their homes, losing their livelihoods, and any cash to keep their children safe.
In your view, can that become a permanent part of society? I mean, I can imagine a political response which says we're sort of preemptively subsidizing people to live in risky places, or that we know shouldn't be, like, society doesn't generally want to pay for. So, you know, how do you think about the balance between those techniques, which I think sound very, you know, they sound really good and I think probably would be effective, versus sort of these like managed retreat and pullback areas?
So I think that raises an excellent point. There are tools available to encourage that type of behavior. Some things that are being considered, for example, are reductions for insurance. If you take measures to protect your home against flooding or wildfire. Other examples are for crop insurance. Requiring the farmers to invest in drought resilient seeds in order to receive cheaper crop insurance turns out has a huge payoff. More farmers get insured, which insurance means that they have a better outcome if they are hit hard because they have a recovery. So there are many mechanisms that can be used to drive that early investment in reducing risk, recognizing that these events will occur, but we will have had an overall lowering of the harm that's resulting from these catastrophic events.
So what is malmitigation and how can it be avoided?
Malmitigation is a term that's kind of thrown around to just point out that whenever we make choices, either to adapt or cut our emissions, we need to be considering both sides of the climate coin, because we can make a decision to adapt, for example, that has not so great outcome when it comes to mitigation. I'll give you some examples. Let's take hydropower. Hydropower is clean energy and it's highly desirable. But if drought strikes, the availability of hydropower drops precipitously. And a 2018 study found that drought-stricken regions saw a substantial increase in their emissions, particularly carbon dioxide, as they struggle to find alternative power supplies. The same thing occurs with solar power. There's been this explosion of solar power. The head of the International Energy Agency has called it the king of green energy. It's an investment that stretches in some cases for miles with these huge solar farms, or you see them on top of single family residence. In short, it is solar power is the poster child for green energy. But it turns out that when you have big wildfires and wildfires, the types of wildfires that we're seeing now that can burn more than a million acres in a single fire, hadn't experienced that before. These fires burn hotter and can sometimes have their own weather, a firenado, and the embers fly further, increasing the damage. When you have wildfires, solar power drops. And that's because the ash from those wildfires settles on the solar panels themselves, reducing the effectiveness of their ability to generate solar power. So in 2018, California saw a 13% drop in its production of solar power during the fires. And Australia, similarly, which, by the way, has the highest number of houses and businesses with rooftop solar, saw a drop in their production of solar in Canberra and Sydney by 45%. What happens is when there's a drop in solar power, many communities resort to going back to fossil fuel emissions, fossil fuel generated power, which increases the emissions. The point of this is that you have to plan for the uncertainties and the variabilities that increasing, worsening climate impacts bring to locations. And that needs to be incorporated, considered in the planning for how much power you need, what will happen to the power generation, and what backup systems you will deploy.
To close, your book uses personal storytelling to describe the evolution of your own thinking on climate resilience. It felt like an intentional choice to me. Do you think that rhetorical technique has a key role to play in communicating how to think about resilience and the nature of climate risk more generally?
I think that narrative is key. That's how humans learn. That's how we relate to each other. I remember one climate expert being asked, what would you do differently now that you have been in the climate field for several decades? And she said, tell more stories. And I thought, yes, that's absolutely right. This is a technical field, however. It doesn't always lend itself to stories, but stories are essential. So honestly, when I was writing the book, I tried out two different styles. One where the third person, which is far more familiar to me because I'm a former lawyer and that's how I've been trained to write and have written for many years. But I also tried out the I. And I have to tell you that the initial readers, as I was exploring this, were pretty unanimous. You really need to go with the I, and it kept encouraging me, find more places that you can put in the I. I move forward. I hope that I can overcome that tendency to want to put that distance and really express it in more personal terms, because climate change affects all of us. It'll affect me. It affects my family. I worry for my children. I worry for their children. And speaking more honestly about that, I hope will resonate, help me meet people where they are, and encourage us to all think about how we could build a better future together in face of this change that will occur if we don't act we will have very bad outcomes. So how do we motivate ourselves and each other to really focus on this? So narrative is key in my belief for accomplishing that. And I hope I can find even more stories to share with folks so that they can appreciate what climate change could mean and how they could play a role in having better outcomes.
Great. Well, thank you so much. The I is Alice Hill. The book is The Fight for Climate After COVID-19, and The Nation is in Need of a Climate Adaptation Plan. Thank you so much for joining us on Energy 360, and all the best.
Thanks to Alice for returning to the show. We always learn so much from her insights. There's a link in our bio to her book, The Fight for Climate After COVID-19. And you can find more episodes of Energy 360 wherever you listen to podcasts or on our website, csis.org. As always, follow us on Twitter @CSIS Energy for more updates, and thanks for listening.